You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. This is the first of two episodes about rethinking waste, made by Melbourne Uni students as part of the Science Gallery exhibit, Disposable. First up, we're going to get groceries. Bring your shopping list, reusable bags, and a head torch. Instead of going inside the supermarket, we're going to have a look at what's around the back, in the bins.
The lights are off, which is a good sign. What else we got in there?
Charlie is on the hunt.
So far, it's looking great. First bag that we've opened, and we got lots of delicious foods in here, so no complaints.
My name is Charlie. I am a performer. I do stilt walking performance at festivals and events around Melbourne and around the state.
But that's not all Charlie does. Once a week, Charlie dumpster dives for almost all of the food he consumes. Not because he can't afford it, but because he doesn't want to see it go to waste. Tonight, I'm meeting him at 10 p.m. sharp for a group dive in Melbourne's northern suburbs.
Hey. Hello. How's it going?
We just moved in 2 months ago.
That's Charlie's partner, Jenny. She introduced Charlie to dumpster diving almost 5 years ago.
You want to have a look at our fridge? This is the kind of things we found also. Falafel, more strawberries, more ice cream. Yogurt is the same. Might have at least 3-4 kilograms of yogurt. All the greens. All is dyed. Everything in the fridge.
There's a number of reasons I do it now. The fact that you know the food is there, regardless of whether you get it or not, it almost seems ridiculous to go inside the supermarket to get the food when it's sitting out the back. There's also a little bit of like an excitement factor as well, like what are we going to find? You feel a little bit naughty doing it. Even after 5 years, it's still kind of like, ooh, find some treasures.
But there are rules for keeping yourself safe.
I find smell and taste are usually pretty good gauges of whether something's good or not. Sight, obviously, do a triage when you're at the bin, pulling out some apples. Some of them are looking a bit dodgy. You might leave those ones behind. After 5 years, having had zero issues, I think I'm probably a little bit less strict than Virginie in what I eat. The yogurt can be a little bit older. A little bit of tang doesn't bother me.
We've arrived. It's just us, a dimly lit empty car park, and a bin.
Open, sesame, open, ouvre-toi. So here you have a little crank. Oh, wow. Oh, yes, there's a lot here, guys. Woohoo!
This bag has some good stuff, I can see. Extra virgin olive oil.
Oh,
unopened.
Wow.
Traditional Middle Eastern hummus. Oh, there's so much good stuff.
I see the stuff in the bin, I'm already thinking about what I'm gonna do with, because it's so much. You're like, okay, so I can use that if I have friends coming, I can do a big pot, or I can take that for work.
We hit the jackpot, finding boxes and boxes of Dutch chocolates that had just passed their best before.
But it's chocolate, yeah. It's sugar,
it's
packaged and preserved. It's traveled across the world to be here in this bin for us to find.
Lamb and rosemary pie, baguette, yes.
So this is the part where we have to decide what to take and what not to take. This is kind of an every night occurrence. We take what we feel like we can use or redistribute. There's not enough hungry people to eat at all. It's definitely a systemic issue. Like it's not a matter of what do we do with all this food. It's what, how do we change the system to prevent this food from arriving here in the first place? If you consider the sunk energy in an item of food, all of the water and the electricity and the energy that's gone into producing food items and the transport of food items across the world. Like we've seen items from various countries around the world tonight, which were brought here at an energy cost and then just got chucked out. And then
this is the main problem, the intensity of how we produce our food today, and the fact that those people already know that half of it is going to be wasted, and this is not a problem for them.
when you see stuff like one of the major supermarkets recently I went in there for something small, and they had a promotion that was encouraging shoppers to donate 50 cents to this Feed the Hungry of Melbourne campaign that they were having. And in their bin, it's like every single night enough food to feed all of the hungry people.
Yeah.
Just kind of like, it's so hypocritical. They're so totally fake. In an ideal world, I would prefer that there was nothing in the bins for me to eat. But as long as there is, I'll keep taking it.
That story was produced by Danielle O'Neill, Inna Kivset, Doreen Lee and Christina Liu. The supervising producers were Eugenia Sivchenko and Jordan Fennell. Plenty of waste happens during food production. But banana farmers Rob and Krista Watkins have found a way to save their green bananas from the dumpster and turn them into a whole new product.
I wouldn't even wish it on my worst enemy. It's awful. Your thumbs are sore. You feel like you've got blisters in places on your hands that you never even knew you could get a blister. It is absolutely torturous.
That's Krista Watkins. She and her husband Rob are Queensland banana farmers. 10 years ago, they made a discovery that's making use of the 500 tonnes of bananas thrown away each week in Queensland.
Simply because it was maybe misshapen, maybe it was too big or small, and then also a lot of it was that there was just an oversupply on the market. It was always something that didn't really sit well with either of us.
In 2006, Cyclone Larry hit far north Queensland, destroying most of their crops. A few years later, Cyclone Yasi would do the same. Having been affected by two devastating cyclones in the space of 5 years, Rob and Krista were looking for a way to diversify and de-risk their livelihood.
With the two cyclones, after that, we definitely thought, oh, there has to be a way to kind of foolproof our business, you know, there had to be a better way.
That better way came one day by accident.
Rob was loading the truck with the forklift and he drove over something and it made a really loud noise. And he hopped off the forklift to see what had happened. And what he found was he'd driven over a hand. So a hand is about 5 to 6 bananas that must have been sitting on the road for a few days. And what he saw was like a powder inside. You know, most people would have looked at that and gone, oh, it's just waste, more bananas to throw away. But I suppose instead of seeing waste, he saw the opportunity that to him it looked like powder inside.
Keen to find out more about their newfound product, Rob and Krista sent samples to a lab for testing.
When I took the phone call from the lab, I was actually quite worried because the lady was in a rush. She really needed Rob straight away about these samples that he'd sent her. And my initial thought went, oh no, someone's going to get sick or die from this stuff. But in fact, it was quite the opposite. We had accidentally discovered the richest form of resistant starch. And while it doesn't sound like much, it is a really significant scientific breakthrough, especially when gut health and prebiotics.
Since discovering green banana flour, Rob and Krista have transformed their business from a banana farm to the world's first commercial banana flour factory. Under their brand Natural Evolution, they're turning every 10 kilos of wasted green bananas into 1 kilo of marketable banana flour.
So we moved into a little old cold room on the farm and Rob started making some equipment there to make the peeling process easier because that was the biggest pain for us at the time. With that small little pilot plant, we were able to produce about 350 kilos a week. We sat there probably for 18 months, 2 years, and we went, this is it. We are really going to go this wholeheartedly. We are going to go and build a massive factory to produce banana powder, and we did.
Now, not only are they producing banana flour, they can turn any vegetable to powder, which helps to support other farmers too.
Late last year, we had 60 metric tons, which was an entire field of broccoli sent up from Victoria to be processed. There was an oversupply on the market, so otherwise that farmer would have just ploughed it back into the ground where it was growing. Wasn't worth him sending it. It would have cost him money to send it to market. Instead, he was able to harvest it, stem, leaves and all, send it to us, and we processed it into a really highly functional food source that has a shelf life now of at least 3 years.
Seeing the positive impact their business has had, Krista and Rob are now looking at expanding to new markets.
So we have planned a much bigger factory to go in next year in North Queensland. I think that what we're doing now, taking in other people's crops in Australia, but now we're also setting up farmer cooperatives so that more processing facilities can be set up throughout the world using our technology to give farmers an alternative industry that will deliver highly nutritious food to people who need it. For us, it just makes sense to use what we already have rather than creating more agricultural land to grow more food to inevitably just throw away more. So for us to be able to use everything we have and give it a different perspective and a different opportunity, yeah, that's the natural evolution way.
The days of peeling green bananas by hand are now a thing of the past for Krista and Rob. They can now go from banana to flour in a rapid rate.
When we first started with the hand peeling kind of operation, we had it took about 24 hours. Now that we've got our factory, and because we are continuing to evolve our technique, we've got it down to about 10 minutes. So, yeah, it's been pretty cool.
That story was produced by Grace Aiken, Zhu Bai, and Meng Yu Chi. Jordan Fennell was the supervising producer. Lots of people are trying to lead a greener life. But what about a greener death? I've always been fascinated by the idea of a Tibetan sky burial, where a body is left on a mountaintop to be eaten by vultures. If you don't have easy access to a Tibetan mountaintop, our next story might give you some less dramatic ideas of how you can be eco-friendly from beyond the grave.
Have you ever thought about what you leave behind when you die? In Australia, there are two legal options for our bodies once we're gone. We can be buried in a cemetery plot or cremated, our ashes scattered or kept in an urn on the mantelpiece to spook the living. But here's the thing. Disposing of bodies in this way can be pretty bad for the environment.
We all use more than is our fair share. And the idea that we continue that into death, it just seems mad to me.
That's Siobhan Motherway, a woman from Melbourne. Now she's 40, she's thinking about her future and the planet's. Her will asks for the most eco-friendly funeral possible.
But we attempt to keep our lives as low impact as possible. That, I guess, was a process that came along in parallel with this idea of thinking about my death and our death and what might happen to us afterwards. I don't need a pyramid or a sarcophagus or or even a headstone. It's not really something I'm that attached to.
To build the world's coffins and caskets, we cut down a forest the size of the MCG each year. Burial space is running out in urban areas, our bodies are embalmed with toxic chemicals, and cremation puts deadly mercury and CO2 into the atmosphere. And who wants to be remembered for that? A green burial does away with all the bells and whistles of traditional body disposal, in favour of a low-impact exit.
And it's about not consuming anything, and it's about reducing your carbon footprint. First of all the consumables that a traditional funeral would have, like flowers and booklets and coffin and transport. And then, you know, if you're buried in a traditional cemetery, there's all the care of the gardens and the cemetery itself. So the consuming continues on, you know, forever.
That's Samantha Rennie from Tobin Brothers Funerals. Ever since starting her work, Samantha's seen people change their priorities when dealing with the dead.
I think there's a generational shift around that that's happening, you know, as the baby boomers are now coming in and wanting funerals, and then Gen Xers as they're coming in. I think there's more and more permission to do something that's very individual and represents the self and what society thinks isn't as relevant.
But for many, funerals aren't just about getting rid of bodies. The ceremony can bring closure. Headstones, plaques and urns let people continue bonds with the dead, which is what Rosa is doing at her husband's grave.
I'm Catholic, Roman Catholic. Funeral is important for me because he's coming priest and he's have mass and he have everything proper funeral. That is my mom and my dad is like that and my husband, and I'm so happy.
The green burial ethos of leaving no trace is at odds with tradition in many cultures. Rosa has been visiting her husband's grave at least twice a week for 9 years.
In a cemetery, absolutely not. Every week to clean up, to put a flower on, and check up my Swiss candle on all the time. And I must go. That's it.
But the more we got to know about Siobhan, the more it seems her decision is not just about practicality either. It's part of her own spirituality.
I suppose it's an extension of some of my beliefs as atheist, in that I don't believe that my consciousness, my conscience, my spirit, such as it is, will have any presence, or it will not be once I die. I don't believe that I'm going anywhere after I'm dead. And at that point, my task is to do as much good or to be of as much value to my family, my community, my planet, as I can be while I'm alive.
Having a green funeral doesn't mean doing away with memorial entirely.
Natural burials, even though you don't have a tombstone, they still sometimes put rocks or stones as a marker.
If it's something that my children want, if they need a place to go and grieve or remember or lay flowers or anything like that, I like trees. They give a lot of value to the world. They provide homes for creatures. They give us oxygen. They're a long-term investment in the health of the planet, and they're beautiful. And frankly, if my body turns into a tree, that seems to me the best possible outcome.
That story was produced by Dino Vlahos, Jess Cockerill, Yingxuan Li, and Jingyi Lai. Eugenia Zubchenko was the supervising producer. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you want to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us from anywhere in Australia. We also have a team of wonderful supervising producers to help you. Email contact@allthebestradio.com. There's no doubt that Melbourne's first safe injecting room is saving lives, but many locals aren't happy about it being in their backyard. A content warning. This next story deals with addiction and contains descriptions of intravenous drug use.
I'm sitting in a park in North Richmond. To my left, it's a health centre and a cafe. People are milling around, listening to music and chatting. But this is the middle of what people call the rectangle of death. Look a little closer and you'll see plastic disposable syringes in the streets.
If you've got an urban designer to design an inner city illicit drug using area, you would design North Richmond.
That's Judy Ryan. She knows the rectangle well and she's seen it all. Not just syringes, but people overdosing.
I was coming home from work one day and I heard all this screaming, and she'd come out of a toilet block, rang 000, but the ambulance were too late and she died. And it was about 20 past three on a beautiful sunny May afternoon. So I could hear the bell going at the school, and the little kids were coming out of the school going past this dead woman on the street.
Judy now carries a syringe of naloxone in her handbag, which she can use to reverse overdoses if she needs to. In July 2016... she came across a man overdosed in the alleyway beside her house.
And I really just thought, this is insane.
He was the same age as her son. It was a turning point.
So I Googled, you know, drug injecting, and I came across the injecting room in Sydney. I thought, oh, that sounded like a really good idea. So in my head, I kept thinking, you know, they should do something about it.
Judy's talking about politicians, and they weren't doing anything about it. But Judy isn't someone who gives up easily. There's a poster on her fridge that says, "Don't get mad, get elected." And that's exactly what she decided to try and do. She put her name down to run for local council on a single issue, a safe injecting room.
And I remember walking out and I just shook, physically shook. And I thought, what have I done? What am I thinking, you know?
But it turned out she wasn't the only one who wanted things to change. That year, 34 people had died.
34. It was a really cold Sunday morning and 700 people came out and marched.
And then something unexpected happened.
I got a call from local member Richard Wynne's office to say, you better come and meet him.
The government had decided to go ahead with a trial, the centre became one of only two safe injecting rooms in the country.
The first day they opened, they didn't think anybody would come, and at about 10:30 this Aboriginal man walked in and sort of said, oh, is it true that I can inject here? And they said, yes, you can. After he'd done that, he did a welcome to country. He said, you know, we've needed this for a long time.
Since that day, the safe injecting room has been used by thousands of people. In the first 9 months, 650 overdoses were treated, and more than 100 people have entered drug treatment programs. But not everyone is happy.
I initially was very supportive of the injecting facility, but I really don't think it is an adequate long-term solution.
That's Archie. She lives in a different part of the rectangle, just down the road from the centre. She thought the facility would be a solution to the drug problems, but the drugs haven't gone away.
Shocking pictures of a man using a syringe as a child stands next to him have reignited debate about the North Richmond drug injecting room.
The photo went viral on social media. Archie was really affected by it.
Just seeing this child got me really upset because I just thought he's scared. His dad's probably struggling with all sorts of mental health issues and he couldn't take...
Archie's part of a Facebook group called Move the Injecting Room, all caps. Members of the group went down to a meeting on a cold Wednesday night at a Richmond pub. Inside, every chair is taken and people are sitting on the floor.
I'm going to give the microphone back to the lady, but I've got to say, we've already told you, everybody knows, we know what's going on. That's why these people are here, they live here.
A lot of people living in Richmond are angry. One resident says he doesn't feel safe.
I walk out of my front door and the first thing I do when I walk out is look left and right. If there's unsavoury activity, I walk back in, I won't walk out.
People have come to this crowded room because they want to find solutions.
No, we're all in the same boat. You're all living here together. None of us have got all the answers. We're all trying to grope around looking for a way forward, right?
Most people agreed the centre should continue to exist, but they wanted it moved to a less residential area. For now, the future of the safe injecting room is uncertain. The trial period ends in a year, and if no compromise can be reached, its licence might not be extended.
I know it's not perfect, absolutely not. It's totally imperfect, but what was happening before was unacceptable, so something had to happen.
That story was produced by Else Kennedy, Claire Kappel-Stanley, Yunfei Wang, and Fangying Zhao. Jordan Fennell was the supervising producer. I love dogs. I recently moved and I no longer live with any dogs. It is the worst. Everyone should have a dog. If you're allergic, then just get a hypoallergenic dog. Here's a list of all of my favourite dogs. Cooper the Bitzer, Ollie the Schnoodle, Nikki Golden Retriever, Hildy Greyhound. I don't know any St. Bernards, but if I did, they would be on this list. Sophie.
Meet Zorro, Sitka and Mia, three huskies living in the Melbourne suburb of Lilydale with Ed and Rebecca McGaw. Ed and Rebecca moved over from Canada to Australia and moved to Victoria, where they came across Animal Aid, a place of refuge for lost, unwanted and abandoned animals. That's where they met Zorro for the first time.
Yes,
you want a
good
treat?
Boy.
Come on.
Yes, you
come
are.
Over here. Can you talk? He likes to talk. Can you talk?
Zorro was too busy to talk, chowing down on his treat. So we spoke to Ed instead.
We got to know the people at Animal Aid. We were called in by one of the nurses over there and said, we have a six-year-old that is going to be ready for adoption soon. Would you like to look at him? And we came over and saw Zorro and said, Zorro, you're for us. Yeah, he's a good boy.
Oh,
he's a handsome fellow too.
As confident as Zorro is around people, his two furry friends, Mia and Sitka, are a little more reserved, and life hasn't always been a walk in the park.
The two girls are what they call puppy farm dogs, which means that they were put in cages almost their whole life. They've been in cages, and the whole purpose was to breed the puppies.
When the two sisters, Mia and Sitka, were taken in by Animal Aid, their conditions were worse than they thought.
The shelter
a manager had told us when they first arrived, and said when they shaved their stomach to desex them, that there was nothing but stretch marks because they had had so many litters that it was just terrible. The physical abuse that they had had, they never had any contact with other dogs, with their other people. They're just left by themselves in their cages. It's just not a good life.
Despite adopting Mia and Sitka around 16 months ago, they're still trying to recover from their traumatic experiences. We took the Huskies for a walk with Ed and Rebecca to find out why did they decide to adopt dogs from the rescue centre.
The first dog, a Husky, that we bought was from a breeder. It was not a reputable breeder. We went to see the pups and found that they were living in one room of the breeder's house, and it was just filthy. It was horrible. And we just buy one of the dogs, but mainly it was to rescue away from that horrible situation.
Despite the different circumstances of Zorro, Sitka, and Mia, they have found a loving home with the McGaws, and they get back what they give.
The value to us is just the companionship and the fun we have. I mean, Sitka can be such a clown. She'd just jump up and down and do all sorts of dances sort of things to amuse us sometimes. It's really funny. And the companionship, like I say, we walk 5 to 8K a day easily, and it's just a lot of fun. It keeps me from getting too big, too fat, and yeah, it's just, the value is really companionship and the physical activity that I go through with them. It really is good for me. I need that.
Not all rescue dogs are as lucky as Zorro, Sitka, and Mia. Some are unable to find suitable homes after they've been disposed of. This is a huge motivation for Ed and Rebecca to adopt abandoned and damaged dogs.
One of the ones that was rescued the same time the girls were, they couldn't find a home for her. But they did find a, what they call an Arctic Animal Rescue Center. Now, she'll probably stay there for the rest of her life, but she was not put down or anything like that. And that's the thing that we really want to avoid. That's one of the reasons why we took Mia, is if someone didn't take her, mainly us, who would? And then what happened?
That story was produced by Future Yang, James Thomas Astley, Ziwi Chen, and Min Mu. The supervising producers were Britta Jorgensen and Jordan Fennell. All of the stories in this episode were produced by Masters of Journalism students at the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne. This was a collaboration between All the Best and Science Gallery Melbourne. Disposable is the theme of this year's Science Gallery exhibition, opening at the University of Melbourne this August. For more info, visit melbourne.sciencegallery.com. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories, and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Alina Godwin. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Erin Dick. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is also a podcast, so subscribe to us. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au.